Thank you. My name is Frank, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm a member of the Lamont Oaks group of Alcoholics Anonymous. We're not in Chicago. We meet about 30 miles southwest of the city. It's just a small little detail. Chicago is one of our suburbs. I've been sober since November 3rd, 1971. And I've been here before. And I'm pleased to return. This is my third time here. And I look forward to seeing some of the people that I've seen tonight. I'm surprised I met so many people that I've run across at different conferences. And I've looked forward to coming back here. I've got good feelings about this this location. Each time I come to Minneapolis, St. Paul area, I come as a different person. And that's kind of neat because several people ago, I was someone else. And you're wise enough to space my appearances over some years to give me time to change to come back. But I'm pleased to see so many people who are presumably new to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought that was cute when you had people stand up. I wondered what was going to happen if you said, did anybody ever come just to use the bathroom or have a cup of coffee or whatever? But you have a lot of involvement here, obviously, and that's really wonderful. How many people are here that have less than 6 months of continuous sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous? Good. If, with the permission of the other people in the room, I would like to address my remarks tonight particularly to you. And now the hands are all over the room, and there were a lot of people here that are new to Alcoholics Anonymous. So I'm not going to be able to look at everyone, but I'm going to kind of center on you and you three. So, you want to be in? Because you see, as I understand Alcoholics Anonymous, the power of this program and why this is different than anything else like it or other kind of approach or therapy for this thing that I have, which is alcoholism, the thing that's different about this is something very special happens when one alcoholic talks to another alcoholic. And that is the foundation of what this is all about, as I understand it. Now, if you're new, I'd like to set some guidelines for this talk. Number one, I am nobody. I have no credentials. I'm appointed by no one. I serve no one. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. My participation in this program is for me to continue to save my life. What I say here is not the right way to think or what you ought to do or think, and I didn't come here to teach anybody anything. You have teachers among you that are sufficiently schooled in Alcoholics Anonymous that don't need my help. I can guarantee you that. And there are a lot of people in this room that know more about Alcoholics Anonymous than I do. And I can guarantee that too. But what I am is an observer. And I have observed what's happened to me and others in Alcoholics Anonymous since November 3rd, 1971. And I have seen the truth as it has appeared before me, and at first I didn't understand it, and I'm going to share with you some perceptions and observations that might make your journey easier. I'm going to tell you some things that are truthful and maybe not pleasing at first glance. When you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous, you focus on the fact that it was hard to get here. And it was hard to get here. The truth, men and women, is this. It's harder to stay here than it is to come here. Now, that is not because Alcoholics Anonymous does not work. Alcoholics Anonymous works today, just like it did in 1939 when it was first put in print in a book called Alcoholics Anonymous, and they said, rarely have we seen a person fail. See, the rest of that says, who has thoroughly followed our path. And people like me don't want to do that. You see, people like me want it to happen. I'm a fighter. I've been a fighter all my life. I was thinking today about that. Several lifetimes ago, when I was young, I still have some glimpse of what that was all about. My sport was boxing, and I did a lot of fighting. I did a lot of fighting in the ring, and I did a lot of fighting out of the ring. And I remember, and I was laughing this afternoon, I was picturing how it was. And I used to have a white sweater, and the only person in this room who ever saw that sweater was my wife, and she's here tonight. And we weren't married at the time, and I would parade around the neighborhood in this white sweater. It was pure white. But on the sweater was sewed letters, you know how you get letters for sports, and boxing gloves. And each glove represented some tournament or weight class division in some tournament that I had won. And what they would give us was patches. And I had all my patches on my white sweater. Now, the truth of the matter is, I wore that white sweater all the time. You see, it really wasn't important to me that I ever won those fights, because I never felt like I won a fight. It was important that you saw that, and that you concluded that I was special, different, and particularly one without fear. And the truth of the matter is, every time I stepped in a ring, I was scared to death. And I think I fought so hard because, I apparently had what it takes to be an alcoholic long before I ever drank. Because when I was in training, I never drank. I mean, it's inconceivable to drink. What you want to do is you want to do 1,000 push-ups every day. You want to be able to run every day. You want to work out in the heavy bag and the speed bag. And I mean, your body is your tool and trade, and you would not drink. But I guess I had what was necessary to make an alcoholic, because you see, when I got in the ring, I had to win. Because if I lost, I was dead. You see, my whole being was what you thought about me, and me not demonstrating to you the real me. And it was a strange thing. And if you're new and you're a fighter, I'm going to tell you something about throwing in the towel. You hear that phrase used all the time, throw in the towel. I don't know where it comes from, but I know that I relate to it, that the second in the corner in the ring, when his fighter is getting beat and his fighter is in danger of being hurt, will throw in the towel. And when he throws in the towel, that means this fight is over. The referee must, he has no discretion, he must go and separate the fighters, and the fight is over. You'll see that on television and boxing sometimes, and the fighter wants to continue to fight, even when the referee says, no, it's over, babe, and he puts his arms around him. The second knows it's over, and the participant still wants to fight. If you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous, throw in the towel. Now, how you throw in the towel is you throw in the towel. It's not really a difficult thing. You just throw in the towel. Now, I'm going to repeat that one more time just so we all got to say. You throw in the towel. Now, here's how you throw in the towel. And the whole towel goes in the ring. And the fight's over. And you never have to fight again. And you're safe. And you can't be hurt. I have a little tissue here. I was just thinking to myself, here's how alcoholics throw in the towel. Why is it so difficult for us to throw in the towel? Because there's a perception that we're going to give up some things, as if we have some power to throw. We're going to reserve the right to do what? I don't know what that is. When I was new to Alcoholics Anonymous, I came here and I was ashamed that I came here. When I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I was, in my mind's eye, a successful career person. I had acquired a degree of success in my chosen profession, which I thought separated me from the average person in that profession. I did not want to let anyone know that I needed help. It is contrary to my nature to need help. I don't know how to accept help also, but that I never could even get to that point, because the defiance in I do not need help or want to have help. I remember the first time I thought of Alcoholics Anonymous, I visualized a Salvation Army kind of a thing. I had no idea what Alcoholics Anonymous would look like. And if you're new and this is your first look at Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I look just like you, and we look like each other. If you come around here to compare yourself out, you're not going to be able to do that at this meeting, because I'm not going to talk an awful lot about drinking. And the reason I'm not going to talk about drinking is if you're new, you know everything there is to know about drinking. What could I tell you about drinking you don't know? You are the authority in your whole family about drinking. I mean, you might be the authority in your whole place of employment about drinking. And when I was new to Alcoholics Anonymous, I knew everything there was to know about drinking. What I didn't know is, how do you live as Frank Milos without having to drink to stand it? Now, that was an impossible thing. Impossible thing. Just absolutely impossible. I'll tell you a little bit about myself, because you have to do this in Alcoholics Anonymous, apparently, to qualify. I was a cute little baby. I remember being taught by nuns, and I have fond memories of that. I'm a product of what I think was good education. I remember the nuns told me about being good. And then I met a person called peer pressure, and he told me that good was not good. That nobody likes people who are good. Bad is better. And I remember when I met peer pressure, I thought to myself, wait a minute, run that by me, because I was told that if you're good, you're happy. And I wanted him to like me, and he said, no, if you're good, I'm not going to like you. But I like you if you're bad, because if you're bad, you're good, and if you're good, you're bad. And I remember thinking to myself, that sounds good to me. And then he said, you know, if you're bad, you're cool. And I thought, well, I want to be cool, but as I continue to get bad, it got hot. I could never get it straight. The more I was bad, the hotter it got. I never could get cool. So if you're young and you're new and you want to be cool, don't be cool. And if you want to be bad, it takes an awful lot of effort. It's just a lot easier just to be you. And you don't really have to change you. You just have to change the way you have come to believe in who you are. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, we hold out to you hope. And what we do in our stories is give you an idea by our stories what have happened to us, in some sense that you get hooked on the idea that maybe, yes, this could happen to you. I'm not supposed to have made it. Everybody wrote me off. I had almost written myself off. When I was young, I knew that I had a problem, and I didn't know what it was. I always felt different than the other kids, and as many of us seem to relate, I didn't know what it was. By the time I was a teenager, I knew that my problem was definition. I did not understand definitions. Other people did. Here's the kinds of words that the people around me would use that baffled me. And they seemed to intuitively know what the hell they were talking about, one to the other. They would talk about comfortable. I don't ever remember being comfortable. I remember feeling frightened. I remember feeling less than. I remember all kinds of feelings, and I don't remember comfortable. As I look back on my life and into my life, I don't know anything about comfortable. They talk about things like happy. I spent my whole life trying to appear acceptable to you. I've given out more energy in trying to find your approval. And I have never been happy. I've always felt that if I could get the approval of enough people, somehow maybe by a boomerang effect, I would get my own. Can I tell you that I almost died trying to make that happen? In Alcoholics Anonymous, they gave me some tools that allowed me to become comfortable, to have some sense of happy. And I'm going to talk about how I feel, what that means a little later. Here's another word that I think is wonderful. And I'm 15, 16, 17 years old, and I know this is a trap question. How about this word? Enough. Enough. What could you have enough of? I've never had enough power. Friends, admiration, fame, money, sex. I'm slowly getting to the point now that that too changes. But I don't think that's necessarily connected with taking the steps. I think it has something to do with getting older. I never tell jokes. I'm going to tell a joke. I never tell jokes because I'm a poor joke teller. And I never want to become an AA comic. I just don't ever want to do that. When this becomes show business, folks, I'm not participating. I think sharing at meetings is a privilege, but I don't think that people like me are supposed to be entertainers. But in any case, our stories are funny and we are funny people. And if we show ourselves to you figuratively, Bob, we are comical people. I'll tell this joke. This older fellow, guy my age, goes to the doctor and says, "Doctor, it's not working." And the doctor says, "Oh, well, that's not uncommon at your age." The fellow says, "Well, Doc, is there anything we can do about it?" He says, "Yeah, we can do a drug therapy, and it's over a period of time, and maybe that will help what your problem is." And he says, "Well, Doc, how much does that drug therapy cost?" He says, "About $3,000. He says, "Well, is there anything else we can do to, get it to work?" He said, "Yeah, there's an operation. Now, the operation and the aftercare is almost guaranteed to work. And how much does that cost?" "It's about $30,000, but you'll have a sex life again." So he said, "Why don't you go home and talk it over with your wife?" And he does. And the next week he comes and says to the doctor, "Well, I talked it over with my wife." And the doctor says, "Well, what have you decided?" And he said, "Well, we've decided to redo the kitchen." The older people laugh at that one. When I got a perverted understanding early on when I was a kid. I mentioned these nuns. I remember about the fact I learned about God from women who were dressed in black and white. And they were old women. They were 20, 21, 22. To me, they were old women. And I remember they would tell us about sin. And I remember that this particular nun took me and a bunch of other people in a classroom and described God and sin. And here's what she said. She said that there are two types of sin. One is venial sin and one is mortal sin. I don't know if any of these things are true, but I remember that. This is my memory of what she said. And I remember I was 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 years old, and she said that there are many, many venial sins, and she said they showed what they were. And it was like she had a scroll, and there are thousands of venial sins. I mean, everything you can imagine is on there. And she said, if you do those things and you die, you must be punished because you've offended God. I remember thinking, I do that stuff. I mean, it's like not honoring your mother and father. I mean, telling an untruth. I mean, taking something that doesn't belong to you. I mean, treating somebody unkindly is a vehicle by which I offend God, and by the result of which I'm going to be punished. So by the time I'm 8 or 9 years old, I knew that I was dirty, I was destined to punishment, and that I have offended God. Now, that's a funny way to grow up, and I don't know that they ever said that. That's what I heard, and I don't know that the other kids heard that. But I remember in the seventh grade when that same woman came in and she asked all the girls to leave. And this is an interesting kind of a thing, and I knew we were going to get into some deep stuff because we had already covered mortal sin by this time. By the third grade, we were into mortal sin. And there aren't as many mortal sins, but I love the subject. Every mortal sin she ever described, I wanted to do. And I knew I would do. I mean, there was stuff about other people's wives, and I wasn't even married. I was about 11, and I knew I was going to do that at least once. Later, I found out once was not enough. And I thought to myself, this is going to be heavy stuff, and I was right, because she got out, all the girls out of the room, and then she said, "Boys, God sees in the dark." I thought to myself, "Oh yeah? I bet you guy can't see under the covers." And you know, I forced myself to believe that God couldn't see under the covers, but I lied to me because I knew he could. And I knew that I had habits and thought processes and that were offensive to God and that I seemed not to be able to reject. By the time I'm a teenager, I know that I have a bag of secrets that I will never share with another human being. And a lot of those things had to do with normal sexual experimentation, normal sexual exploration. And I thought it was weird and dirty and degenerate. And I remember by the time I'm 20 years old, I don't feel less dirty, I feel more dirty. Because between the time I was 10 and the time I was 20, I accumulated more guilt and more secrets, more actions, and more things that were inconsistent with being good that I never thought I'd ever be good again. And I never thought that God could ever forgive me for what I had done. And I was hoping that he really couldn't see under the covers. And pretty soon, I was hoping he couldn't see through the roof. And pretty soon, I was hoping he couldn't see through the clouds. And pretty soon, I just made him die. And God died when I was in college. I remember that I was a philosophy major, and the power of being a philosophy major was that I was able to intellectually kill God. And that's kind of an interesting thing for another night. We'll talk about that another time. It's a little weird, but it's true. One of the biggest things that newcomers want to argue about is surrender, unmanageability, and this word insanity that they see in the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I do a lot of work in and around newcomers, and just recently, I devised a little word picture that I think says it all. And I have no tolerance for newcomers who want to talk about unmanageability or powerless. What do you mean by powerless? And this powerless, and I'm not powerless. And what do you mean by insanity? And I don't want to get involved in that stuff. I don't want to get in that because it's silly. It's a waste of time. Does anybody have a match here? Anybody got a book of matches? Anybody? It's only take a second. I have 5 grandchildren. I know you won't believe that. I have 5 grandchildren. And no one in my family smokes anymore. And there's really very little use for matches, you know, if you don't smoke. Honestly, think about it. We have electric light bulbs and everything like that at home. And I have a grandson named Danny. And up to last year, I don't think Danny had ever seen a match. I don't think he's ever seen a match. And you know, when you're little, and Danny's was only 3, you don't know anything about fire until somebody teaches you about fire. So I'm going to tell you something if you're new. I'm going to play a little game. Let's suppose that I went over to Danny's house. These are wonderful matches. And Danny loves me. To me, I am bigger than life. I am Papa. Danny loves me. And I said, "Danny, come here, Danny. Touch this. Look at Danny, how pretty this is. Touch it. What do you think Danny would do? Young lady, what do you think he'd do? He'd touch it. You know why? He trusts Dad, Papa. And he knows that it is bright and it's shining and there's some attraction. And I say, Danny, touch this, and he would touch this. And what would happen? He would get burnt. And he would run away, wouldn't he? Let's go back the very next day or a week later and say, hi, Danny, Papa's here. This must be a joke, these matches. Danny, look what Papa has for you. Why don't you touch this? What do you think you'd do, young lady? He what? He'd run? Do you think he'd touch it? Why wouldn't he touch it? He would burn? Would he remember the circumstance of the week before or day before? I have a question. You're new, and you're new. Danny's 3. How old are you? 21? 24. How many times did you touch the fire? You don't mind if we skip talking about unmanageability and sanity? Okay, we'll just skip that. You see, that's exactly what my problem was all my life. I just kept doing it over and over and over and over and over again. I knew I was an alcoholic long before I ever wanted to admit I was an alcoholic. Who the hell wants to admit they're an alcoholic? Remember I told you when I came here I was ashamed I was here? I was ashamed I was here. In my mind, this was weakness, this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. I stayed long enough to find out it is the greatest power. You see, I can drink today. You know that? I choose not to. I did not have that power November 2nd, 1971. I could not control my drinking. And the point is, here's the newsflash. I never quit drinking. The need to drink was removed. Isn't it a strange phenomenon? I'm going to tell you what I was in one short word picture, and then we won't talk about drinking anymore. We have a beginner's meeting where I come from, and it's really a wonderful experiment, and it really turned out to be the highlight of my Alcoholics Anonymous life. And if I look over my Alcoholics Anonymous life, besides saving my life, my participation in that beginner's meeting has been the most fulfilling thing I've ever done. And all I do is have a little part in it, and I'm no big deal there. But one day, I was going to appear before the beginner's meeting, and there were about 40 or 50 newcomers in the room, and we have designed the meeting to tell them the truth. Here's the truth. Remember I told you how hard it is to stay here, and it's harder to come here? And it's not because this doesn't work. It's because if you're like me, you won't work it. You see, this is the strangest disease. This is not like cancer or AIDS. You see, if I had the cure for AIDS, and I said, folks, I have the cure for AIDS, and if you have AIDS, you would not argue with me. You would not discuss with me. You would say, please give me the cure. And I'd say, well, wait a minute. It's really 12 actions. Tell me what to do. And you, without any hesitation, without any intellectualizing, you would do those things. And you'd do that if it was you were blind and this could restore your sight. You think of the illness, and I tell you that the sufferer from that illness enthusiastically will grasp recovery, not in alcoholism. Can you imagine what happens here? Here's what happens here. Someone says, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path, and all you have to do, if you want what we have and to be restored to sanity, is to do those things. And we say, we'll think about it. I'm not ready to take that step. This is the only disease from which the sufferer has no enthusiasm for recovery unless
the pain is so great that the motivation comes from pain and not from intellectual investigation. So I hope you hurt. I hope you hurt so bad. I hope that the tears that are in your eyes today, you remember, and we take pictures. I think we ought to have videotapes. I think we ought to have videotapes, so when you come in the first day, we take your picture, and we ought to give you a microphone and say, you've got 3 minutes, say anything you want. And then 5 minutes, 5 years later, let you buy that videotape. Otherwise, we'll show it to the world. All kidding aside, so you never forget that look, that feeling, because it's we are motivated by pain and not by some choice of intellectual or spiritual. I prayed a lot before I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, so I'm not going to come up here and tell you I found God in Alcoholics Anonymous and I learned how to pray. I knew there was a God. I knew there was a God from the time I was a kid. Whether I offended him or not, I knew he or she or it existed. I knew I did not understand God. I could not picture God, and I wasn't so sure that the way he was being painted to me was the real way he or it existed. But I knew there was a God. And I prayed. I prayed many nights and many mornings. Here's my prayer. God, what's wrong with me? God, help me. And I prayed out of frustration, out of fear, and I wanted that help. And I know most alcoholics have prayed. So God existed before I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and he exists now. So I don't want to come here and let you and try to pretend that I didn't have a God before, but I have a God now. That's not true. That is not true. The consistent God has always been present. I remember one guy said to me, I don't understand this thing about make a decision to turn our will or our lives over the care of God, as if that empowers God. Think of that. A lot of newcomers will tell me, well, it's hard to make a decision to turn my life and will over the care of God. He's got it already. What are you giving him? I mean, if you don't make the decision, does he have no power? Does he not have our lives? Of course he does. Of course he does. See, the truth of the matter is, I'm going to tell you, there are two kinds of people you'll meet in Alcoholics Anonymous, from my observation. You'll have behavioralists and you'll have spiritualists. And that's true. And that's true. And behavioralists believe that if you continue to act right, your thinking will be right, and you will be restored to sanity and recover from alcoholism. And I tell you, that sounds good, but I tell you, I don't know that that's right. Because I don't think the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is one alcoholic talking to another. I think that's a thing that is a vehicle, but I think the message is one alcoholic talking to another about this. The fact is, young lady, that God could and would if he were sought. And that's what Alcoholics Anonymous is. Maybe to give you the right, to give you the license to surrender and to accept the fact that God loves you. He loves you the day you were born. He loves you exactly the same way that you sit here tonight with tears in your eyes. And don't be so afraid about crying. Don't feel so unique about crying. You want to know something? Most of us have cried. Even the tough guys cried. You want to see something? I want you to look around the room. How many people in this room, before they came to Alcoholics Anonymous, cried about the frustration in which they found their lives? Look around. That's why we're the same. That's why we're the same. Don't look at us as old or young, or they got this and I don't have that, education or resources or anything. That's why we're the same. Because we understand. And that's why something special happens when you and I talk. You can't look me in the eye and say, like you could say to your mother or your sister or your employer or your husband or your child, but you don't understand. The truth of the matter is, yes, I do. And so do you. That beginner's meeting that I talked to you about, one day I walked in there and I said, you know, I look in Alcoholics Anonymous and I don't find a definition of an Alcoholics Anonymous approved definition for alcoholic. There isn't any. There's descriptions of alcoholics and alcohol people who have alcohol tendencies, but there is no approved AA definition. And I'm kind of like one of these weirdos that wonder if we're all on the same wavelength. And if I say alcoholic and you picture alcoholic, I mean, we could not be picturing and talking about the same thing. And if that were the case, we'd never ever get on the same track, would we? For example, how long have you been sober now, young lady? 2 weeks. Now, I would like to ask you a question. I want you to go back in your mind 3 weeks. So 3 weeks ago. Had you ever been to Alcoholics Anonymous before? Okay. I want you to go 3 weeks before the first time you came to Alcoholics Anonymous. Okay? Could you put your mind back there? Now close your eyes and be 3 weeks before you ever came here and tell me, I'm going to say a word, tell me what the word looks like. Alcoholic. What do you picture? What do you picture? A bum. How old is the bum? Old bum. An old bum. Old bum. Look old. I know you said middle age. They didn't hear you, and I want to get you up there. What sex is this bum? Male. Isn't that an interesting thing? Do you know that that's common? If you do that experiment with most newcomers, they experience that's exactly what they see, a dirty old man. Well, I'm going to tell you that most of the people in an Alcoholics Anonymous come here when they're not so young, and they grow up to be dirty old men. But the truth of the matter is, and we're not all men. You see, really, we're men and women. But we have that perception, and that's what I thought when I first came into Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to be with some just dirty old bum-like guys, and I wasn't like that. So I want to make sure we're on the same wavelength, so I asked this group of people to tell me, what is an alcoholic? Now, I had, like I say, 40, 50, 60 newcomers in that room. Now, we have a room on Monday night before our regular AA meeting. We have our beginners meeting. We put 250 chairs in the room, and then they are filled every night. Imagine that? Isn't that a wonderful thing? And they come there because the only thing that's different about that meeting is we teach them the truth. And I asked them to tell me what an alcoholic was. You know what they said? Nothing. There was total silence in the room. One of the things you'll notice, you work with newcomers and they put them all in a room and they are around their peer group, they will never, ever volunteer anything for fear you might come to understand that they don't understand. They will not take a risk. They would rather sit there acting like they really are just there as observers, that they're really not sick as the one next to them. So I said to them, since you aren't going to tell me what an alcoholic is, I challenged them to make an alcoholic. Just like we went back in your mind, and I'm not a psychiatrist, and alcoholism is not an Alcoholics Anonymous, is not some psychiatry or metaphysics, so don't get the wrong idea, but I want you to see this word picture. I stood in front of this group of people, and I've stood in front of tens of thousands of newcomers since then with this invisible test tube, and I asked them to make me an alcoholic. I asked people like you who are 2 weeks sober, and you are 65 days, and who's counting sober? And I asked them if there wasn't a definition left to make an alcoholic in a test tube, an invisible test tube. And the reason I want us to do that is that if we see what an alcoholic is, we can relate ourselves out of here. Wouldn't it be neat if we could make it to alcoholic, show you what an alcoholic is, and you can say, that's not me, and leave? Wouldn't it be neat to be a social drinker? Would you like to be a social drinker? You would. No, you wouldn't. You really believe you'd like to be a social drinker, don't you? I'll prove to you that you will never be a social drinker. Pretend I have a pill, and if you take this pill, you will be a social drinker. You think you'll take the pill? No way. No way. No way. It's your perception. Let's test it. Do you ever see a social drinker? Well, let me ask you, have you ever gone out at night saying, well, I think I will out and really have a good time tonight. Let's see, I'll go call a social drinker to go with me. Now, people like you and I don't have a lot of we don't have a lot of experience with social drinkers because we don't find them fun. Okay? I was on a plane recently flying to give an AA talk up in Saskatchewan. And I got on the plane, they gave free drinks on this plane, and they gave them these two beers. And I loved beer in the old days, and they gave these two young guys beers. And they gave them in a cup, and they were Molson Lager beer. I wasn't paying much attention. And they poured the beer into the cups, and I just looked away, and I looked out the window, and about 5 minutes later, I looked back, and the beer was still in the cups. And about 5 minutes later, I looked back, and there was this much gone. I thought to myself, drink the goddamn stuff. You see, that's what social drinking is all about. When a social drinker asks another social drinker to go out and have a drink, that's what they do. They have a drink, and then they go home. How would you like to live like that one day at a time? Social drinkers, when the bartender pours them a drink like the flight attendant, I still call them stewardess and make them crazy, flight attendant gave these two young men that beer, they continue to talk. Why do you want to talk? Let's drink. We'll talk later. Social drinkers, when they're offered a second or third drink, you know what they say? No, thank you. I've had enough. Now, I don't know if you've ever had that experience. The reason that a social drinker says, no, thank you, I've had enough, is because they mean it. How nuts they are. You see, every human being that takes alcohol in their body, something happens. There's a reaction to alcohol. But no matter who you are, if you take alcohol, a certain amount of alcohol, everybody feels a change occur. Everybody does. When the change starts to occur for social drinkers, here's what they feel. They start to feel different. And they don't want to feel different because they like how they feel. And when they start to feel different and the world around them starts to look different, they say, stop! Stop! I'm starting to feel it. I drink because I don't like the way I feel. And when that change starts to occur, I say, more. And when the world around me starts to change from my perception of my alcohol, I say to myself, wonderful, because it becomes less threatening to me and I want more. So when the change occurs for me, I pursue it, and when the change occurs for the social drinker, they reject it. Do you want to be a social drinker? Give me a break. Plus, how boring. They go out, they know when they're going to come home, where they're going to go. I have up that invisible test tube in front of those people. And I said, make me an alcoholic. And there was silence in the room, and then I gave them the threat. Always remember the threat. If you have a bunch of newcomers in a room and they don't want to participate, this is a suggestion. Here's what I said to them. Fine, you don't want to participate, no big deal. Let's see, we have 42 minutes left in the meeting. All right, here's what I'll do. I'll just stand here with this heavy invisible test tube for 42 minutes in total silence. Alcoholic newcomers do not like silence because they start to hear the voices. And rather than hear the voices, a little girl in the back of the room said, put in fear. A fellow who's now dead, he was 60-some years old and was 11 years sober in our group at the date of his death. At that day, and the very first time I did the test tube, say, put in depression. put in anxiety, put in perfectionism, put in loathing, put in guilt. The arms and hands went up like this, like you saw when I asked about crying. The arms and the hands went up. They wanted to put in ingredients. Put in superiority. Put in inferiority. Imagine that in the same test tube. Huh? Put in more guilt. Put in remorse. We had a whole bunch of Irish Catholics. I was giving a talk in Ireland a couple of years ago, and they told me there are three kinds of guilt. There's Irish guilt, Catholic guilt, and Irish Catholic guilt. Put in loneliness. Put in negative self-image. And they went on and on, filling this test tube. And I'll tell you the truth, and this is the truth. I was amazed for a minute, because when they were all through, and there may have been 30 participants into the experiment, it dawned on me, do you know what they didn't put in? They hadn't put in alcohol. And I realized they knew, without even reading the book, they knew the first day that they came into Alcoholics Anonymous that alcohol was but a symptom of the problem, and they were the problem. And we spend years giving them drunk stories. And they knew instantly when they came in here that alcohol was but a symptom of the problem. And so I said to them, you know, you didn't put in alcohol. So we put in some alcohol in the test tube of our mind on that day in the beginner's meeting. And here's what we observed, and I don't know if it's true for you, but it's true for alcoholics of my type. If you put just enough alcohol in the test tube, do you know that alcohol makes fear go away? And alcohol makes guilt go away sometime if you just put the right amount of alcohol. And if you're a coward and you put just enough alcohol in the test tube, you become not only courageous but bold. You might even become aggressive. Do you know that women report to me that if you put just enough alcohol in the test tube, you get prettier? And I'm here to tell you, I've observed that many nights. For people like me, alcohol has a special effect. And as I put alcohol in my test tube, it appeared that the things that were me, that made the very nature of who I was, the frightened, trying to prove something, fit-in guy, alcohol seemed to dilute all of the things that were in my test tube. Now here's the danger, and here's the truth. For people like me, and I don't know about you, when the dilution process starts to become pleasurable, I do not want to stop it. I increase my dosage. And then I get alcoholism. I don't know how I got it. I don't know anything about it. But I know I got it because I know what happened. It stopped working. You know, it never dawned on me intellectually, and I'm a bright guy. I really am no dummy. I tell you that I am not a dumb person. And I never dawned on me to say, you know, Frank, this stuff's not working. You ought to quit it. It never dawned on me. I thought, well, I got to change. I got to drink something else. I mean, I can't keep drinking this beer. I got to change. Maybe I'll just drink martinis or something. Or who I drink with, or when I drink, or how often I drink. And I start to choreograph my drinking. All I want is to be able to drink and have it work again. You see, that's all I've ever wanted to do. Because when it dilutes, I am the best me I've ever known. It might be for a minute or an hour or a whole evening that I just float over and I'm okay. I'm like I want to be. I'm comfortable. I have enough. And I'm happy. God, if I can just keep that, because you know that's all I ever wanted my whole life. You know what binds us all together? Every one of us is alcohol. Forget the alcoholic in the room. Everybody in this room, alcoholic, non-alcoholic, I don't care if they're who it is in this room. If we melt us all down and say, what is the one thing you want? We can give you, I'm the genie that comes out of the bottle, and there's one thing I can give you, and I'll give you one thing. What do you want? And everybody's going to want to be happy. Bottom line, after all the hocus pocus, we all want to be happy. Whatever the hell that means. we know it has something to do with comfortable, and we know it has something to do with the feeling of having enough. People like me that continue to drink after it doesn't work experience something that we never believed was possible. Do you know that by the time I drank up to when I should have stopped drinking, I felt fear? When I continued to drink after that point, I felt a new fear. If you think fear is bad when you're drinking up to that point, you keep drinking when you shouldn't drink, and I'm going to tell you, you think you know remorse, you're going to know a new remorse and a new guilt. And you feel filthy and dirty, you keep drinking past when you shouldn't drink, and I did, and I felt a new sense of self-loathing. You want to talk about fear? Looking behind, wonder who's seeing, what do they know? Alcohol, for people like me, when you put it in your test tube, when it doesn't work, no longer dilutes what's in there, but intensifies everything that's in there. And once it stops working, it never works again. Now here's the good news. That sounds like bad news. Here's the good news. The premise of Alcoholics Anonymous is very simple. If you take alcohol out of the test tube, you will be left with all the things that are in the test tube. Right? And that's the truth. If you just stop drinking, you're not going to recover from alcoholism. I've been told, and I believe. And yet you will hear people around Alcoholics Anonymous says, Alcoholics Anonymous is about not drinking and go to meetings. That may be true, but I've seen a lot of people die. On November 3rd, 1971, no one in Alcoholics Anonymous had more time than I did. Nobody. I was 1 day, 1 hour sober. 1 hour sober. 1 afternoon sober. 1 evening sober when I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous. The night before I walked in, I stunk when I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous. I stunk from every drink that I'd ever drank in my life, and particularly the night before. I stunk. When I was drinking, at the end of my drinking, the alcohol smell came out of every pore in my body. I could smell me in elevators, and I don't care how much mouthwash I used or how many showers I took. Okay? You got the picture? And that's the truth. Now, I got to do this quickly. Let me suggest to you this. In Alcoholics Anonymous, if you just don't drink and you go to meetings, it's my opinion that you will go crazy. If sober was what we had to offer you, now these are just my opinions. This is not Alcoholics Anonymous talking. So if people disagree, that does not make them wrong. But listen to me. Remember I said I was less sober than anybody? When I came in the back page of the book, it said there are a million members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And in November 3rd, 1971, I realized that there were a million people in the world with more sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. That was 22 years and some months ago. By General Services New York records and estimates, based on their every 4 years they do surveys, 99% of all the people presently in Alcoholics Anonymous have less time than me. Now that may sound pretty good for me, but I'll tell you something. I could not move up if they didn't move out. In order for me to go up, the people ahead of me had to leave. And I'm here to tell you that every time I come to this meeting or other meetings around the country or in around the world, and I come every 5 years, I talk to different audiences. People don't stay. And it's not because it's not here. It's because the defiance of people of my type will do it my way. I will do it my way. And I will do it my way. Let me suggest to you, young lady, the greatest impediment you have to your own recovery is your judgment. Your judgment got you here.
and so did mine. So when they say to you in Alcoholics Anonymous, just take a risk, give your judgment over to someone who you would like to be like. That's called a sponsor. Don't pick anybody you want, you like. I did that when I was new. I thought, let's see, I'm going to get a sponsor. I'm going to get somebody that's just like me. Until an old guy said to me, why would you want somebody like you? I said, because I'd feel more comfortable. He says, you don't like you. Why would you want somebody like you? Get somebody you'd like to be like. Okay? To live like. And that's the goal. In the beginner's class, we discovered certain things. And we discovered that we are all the same, and that alcohol had a special effect for us. And when we took alcohol out of our lives, that was the beginning of recovery, not the end of recovery. It's just the beginning. The only people in the world that can recover and change their lives and drink while they take those steps are members of Al-Anon. It's true, because drinking is not a problem for them. There's women that have a little glass of wine while they write their fourth step. We can't do that. I mean, we can't. It's just not in the cards. But I challenge you tonight to go home, and I want you to look at those steps, and I want you to see how little those steps talk about alcohol and how much they talk about God. And that's why I'm going to tell you again. This is about one alcoholic talking to another about God could and would if he were sought. Our whole lives change in the power that we get in Alcoholics Anonymous. And here's the kicker. Every time I got drunk from sober. I had been sober 5,000 times before I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. Sometimes a day, sometimes an hour, sometimes a week, sometimes a month. But I had been sober over and over and over again, but I never could stand being sober, and I got drunk to escape it. Then if you come here and you just repeat that process, what's new? Here's what's new. Do you remember when alcohol worked so well? It really worked well if you are an alcoholic of my type, and there are other types. Those steps are designed to have the same effect that alcohol had for you. Now, isn't that an amazing thought process? We're going to ask you to allow God to take from you the need to drink, and he will, in his time, if you keep coming. One day, you will no longer need to drink, and you will have not given up alcohol. You just will have it removed. And if you don't throw in the towel, he might throw in the towel for you. Okay? And the truth of the matter is, then, if you take those actions have the same effect that alcohol has. Those actions make the fear go away. If you take those actions, you hate yourself less, and you come to understand and receive your own approval. Do you know there's a step there about getting rid of your secrets? There's a step there about getting rid of your defects? There are steps there about making amends so that you don't have to live in the wreckage of the past. I'm here to tell you that what happens in Alcoholics Anonymous is just a reversal of the process of what happens when you use alcohol, when it works. And this always works. But here's the difference. The name of the game in Alcoholics Anonymous is change. Now, you won't like that, and I didn't like that. And my only reason for not liking change was that I perceived that there was pain in change. Now, if you're sitting here and you'd like to live a better life or a different life, I don't know, a better life, but a different life, and you can't seem to be able to do it, and you're almost ready to give up on whether or not you're ever going to be able to get rid of that demon, whatever it is, and it most likely won't be alcohol, I'm going to tell you this. There is no pain in change. Change is pure painless. The only pain that you'll ever experience in the process of change is in your resistance to change. And the more you resist the change, the more pain you feel.
Now, I know what bothers us. And I've heard enough fifth steps. See, one of the nice things about bringing around a long time and participating in this steps is that you get drawn in the recovery process of others. And I know what we write down in that fourth and fifth step has nothing to do with drinking. Sometimes it has to do with what happened to us when we were little girls or little boys, or what we did to other little boys or little girls. It has to do with masturbation. It has to do with hatred. It has to do with killing people. It has to do with injuring people you love. It has to do with offending God. It has to do with dirty secrets. It has to do with a lot of these things. That's the truth. That's what we uncover in these steps. The bottom line is, here's what happens in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm going to sit down. And I didn't tell my story, because I didn't come here to tell my story. I took a day off. I threw that banquet talk away and all the funny lines, because I have a banquet talk that I give and people laugh, and I laugh at myself in the talk, and I talk about when I first came in, and I use things that are true but yet they're humorous. Here's the secret. What's your name? Judy, God loves you. God forgave you, Judy, years ago. The minute you did it and you were sorry you did it, you were forgiven. The secret in Alcoholics Anonymous is, when the hell are we going to forgive ourselves? When are we going to forgive ourselves and quit playing God as if we must suffer more because we're so bad or we're so different? Judy, some people make it and some people don't. And the truth of the matter is, more people left than ever stay in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because there's something about people like me who refuse to surrender and want to do it our own way. And want to be God. And want to make it happen. And be responsible. Surrender. Let Him. Just do what you're told. Just do those steps. You'll hear in Alcoholics Anonymous and people say, there, but for the grace of God. Now, I always troubled when I see that. This is just my little not growing up enough yet to be able to understand that. People talk in Alcoholics Anonymous about the losers and the winners as if somebody that doesn't make it doesn't have God's grace. There, but for the grace of God, go I got the grace, and he or she doesn't. That's crap. In my opinion, God gives every human being exactly the same amount of grace. If he did not, he would not be God, because God cannot differentiate between those he made. God cannot be prejudiced. God can't like one class greater than the other, favor one people, and shorten another bunch of people. God must be consistent and uniform, because God is, that's the essence of God. That's why it's different than being human. God gives every human being the same amount of grace, and he's given it to you, and he's given it to you, and he's given it to me, and he's given it to everybody in the room. Then why will some make it and some not? Because some will choose not to act upon it. And the choice is yours. And it's just that simple. And the greatest AA speakers in the world aren't going to make any difference. And the greatest examples, and the greatest drunkologues, and the greatest amount of laughter we surround you with are not going to ultimately make a difference. The choice is yours. You will either surrender to that concept or you will do it your way. It really is that simple. It's not very difficult. It's just about surrender and throwing in the towel. Now, the hope is this. We're going to offer you something that, beyond your wildest expectations, you think you're going to get something out of here. Bob said it one day to me. And he said, if I had ever write down, if they would have given me a piece of paper, and I hate to do this because you never hear it, you never can repeat it the way it was said when you use somebody else's statement. But he said, if I wrote down on a piece of paper the day I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, what I wanted out of Alcoholics Anonymous, I would have cheated myself. What has happened to me in Alcoholics Anonymous is impossible to happen to any human being. The person that's here today is so different than the person that walked in that it is not, I'm not even recognizable as the same person. And there's very little I did except do what they told me to do and surrender to the concept that God loves me. And that I am clean. And that I'm human. And as a human being, I will never be perfect. I will never be all pure. I'll never be all understanding. I'll never be all sensitive. I'll never be all kind. I'll never be all honest. And I'll continue to disappoint myself. I am going to be 23 years sober in November. And I tell you, I wake up some days and I'm disappointed with how I act. Because I'm not a finished product. So you don't grow up to be live happily ever after in Alcoholics Anonymous. And every time I come here, I'm a better person through Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm growing up here. I don't know where, I was at a pool the other day and I heard somebody say to someone else, where did you grow up? And I'm so happy they didn't ask me that question, because I don't know where that's going to be, but I'm going to tell you something. It's happening. I'm 57 years old and I'm starting to understand what life's all about. And it's about things that Alcoholics Anonymous teach me. It's about love and service. I don't know you, kiddo, and I hope the next time I come here, you're here, and I hope I'm here too. I hope I'm not so smart that I become a finished product. I don't know where it's going to end up, but I'm a better me than I've ever been. And I'm going to keep coming back because I'm a very selfish person. Thank you very much.